hello, and welcome to the first in a series of new podcasts from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and here with me, as he will be every week, is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, you've just returned from Europe, where, of course, immigration has been a big issue on the continent for a while, especially immigration from Muslim countries. But it's especially acute right now, given some of the political dynamics in the region. So just sort of paint the picture for us. What do you see when you're in Europe these days in terms of immigration, in terms of immigrant populations, and also in terms of how the natives in these countries are responding to it?
Well, mostly you're having people are voting with their feet from North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia to get into the southern Mediterranean doorway into Europe, mostly Greece. And the island of Kos, for example, is flooded this summer. And Italy, way up in Tuscany, each city you go to, whether it's Florence or Siena, if you go over to the Italian Riviera, or you go to Genoa, you see in the traditional plazas people from Africa, people from the Middle East, and they're not treated well because they're trying to peddle things and they're trying to solicit and they're trying to beg. And often they're sleeping in public places and they're using public services. So I guess the idea is that whatever third-class citizenry is in the West, it's much better than first-class or second-class citizenry even in the non-West.
And is there a difference between the way that the sort of the everyman – granted, we're talking about a lot of different countries, but sort of the common citizen in these countries reacts to the dynamics with immigration versus the way that the political leadership does?
Yeah, I think so. I think that politically correct EU leaders are way out of touch with politically incorrect public. And you can see people just openly tell people to get away from them, to go home, push them out of the way. Or they're just ignored. They're a shadow population. We should keep in mind that it's the same phenomenon crossing the southern border here in the United States with two or three exceptions. One is that we have a large Latino population, whereas Europe does not have a large African population. They have some Muslims in France and Holland, but they don't have the size of minorities that we do. And then it's an Islamic – much of it is an Islamic phenomenon. So that tends to be a little bit more out of sync in the West than Catholics from Latin America. And then the United States is less a class-bound society. It assimilates and intermarries and integrates people. But that all being said, people from Mexico were coming into California the same reason people from North Africa are going into Italy.
Given the cultural dynamics and the political institutions, everything else that goes into this, in your judgment, is the United States better equipped to deal with the dynamics that come from this than Europe is?
Probably so, because we have a more vibrant economy and we have a more fluid class structure. And as I said, the immigrants share mostly the same religion as Americans, and they have a lot of people, families, more so than in Europe. But again, the United States has the same problem. People are coming from the third world, and given postmodern Western ideas of quality of result, redistributionist great society programs, they feel that they have to provide almost instant parity, and that taxes the social services. So we have this Orwellian situation. If somebody walks across the border from Oaxaca and they can't read or write Spanish and they only have a fifth grade education and they're dirt poor, they've never driven a car, for example, and they come into San Diego or Fresno or Madera, we feel that if they don't have roughly the same existence as native Californians, that were somehow racist or sexist or homophobic or nativist or whatever the ism that we're accused of. And I think that's somewhat true in Europe as well. It's a pre-modern population coming in and it's a postmodern host, and that makes it very strange.
When we talk about there being a little bit of a disjuncture between elite opinion on this and sort of common opinion, for lack of a better term, Is there a point at which there's an inevitable spillover? By which I mean, if you're talking about the elite opinion being in institutions like higher education or the media, how long can that go on before it inevitably sort of drips down into the general population and you see sort of a broader weakening of cultural identity?
Well, I think it already has filtered down and people are getting very upset. I got pneumonia this summer, and I don't know what the cause was. It was a bad flu, and everybody in my area had it. flu shots didn't do any good. And when you would go to, when I would go to Hispanic blood test, get a blood test or vaccination, local Hispanics were angry, and they said, well, we have all these people coming in from Mexico to our town. Mm-hmm. They all have strange respiratory problems, and they're booking up the ER. They're flooding the DMV. They have all these needs, and now we have a middle-class Hispanic population that for the first time is really conflicted because they're tax-paying citizens, and they see that their quality of life is impacted. And they don't like it. And yet their elites keep saying that we're a mosaic, cultural diversity, let's let in more people. And it's hard to know how this is going to end up. But these are people on the left are getting dissatisfied.
Well, that was how it's going to end up is the next question that I was going to put to you. And let's probably separate out Europe and the United States and handle those separately. In the case of Europe, let's say that the general trend here doesn't get arrested, that it stays roughly where it is now. Looking forward, you know, pick your time frame, 10, 15 years. What are the implications for Europe? How does Europe change as a result of that?
Well, I think it's already changing. And when you look at its policies toward, say, Muslim issues in the Middle East vis-a-vis Israel or on politics, because Europe's a democracy and a lot of these people now have integrated into the political system. So it's changing, taking Europe a little bit to the left, or if it's possible to go any further to the left. And more importantly, European demography is flat, especially a country like Germany that's shrinking radically. So it's a force multiplying effect. One immigrant from the third world, former third world, coupled with a family that has 0.5 children is a dynamic that is going to change European society, especially as the population gets older and it needs more immigrants, and yet the immigrants are going to draw on the social services, which the older people don't want to pay for. So it doesn't look good. It's not going to end well.
And how about the United States? If we have the same sort of, on the policy side, the same sort of stasis that we've had recently, what are we looking at down the road?
Well, we have a little bit more advantage if we would just restrict the 1 million people coming in here illegally and go back to a meritocratic, culturally and ethnically diverse system where we let in, say, 100,000 a year, and we could select people from Korea or Africa or Ireland, and we just didn't favor Latinos because they happen to have family members or they're proximate to the borders, then I think the whole thing would work like 19th century Italians. They would be a little bit slower to integrate because their home is so much poorer than, say, Northern Europeans were vis-a-vis Sicily. But eventually, third-generation Hispanics would melt into the body of politics, and you would be no more able to predict their politics than you are, say, a Cuomo or Giuliani. Their ethnic identification would be secondary, not essential to their characters. But the way it is now, when you flood in, deliberately so on the part of Obama and the Democrats, when you flood these people in, they become an unassimilated collective block that gets pandered to and sees as a valuable tool for electoral politics.
There's an interesting dynamic at work here, which you mentioned in the article that's sort of the basis for our conversation today, which is that a lot of the same people who are doing sort of the ideological legwork, the big supporters of really expansive immigration policies, are also people who tend to be very critical of sort of the status quo of life in the United States or life in the West, generally speaking. And yet the rates at which people are coming into our countries seems to undercut that same rationale about how terrible these places supposedly are, right?
Yeah, it's crazy when you comprehend the disconnect. I mean, here in the United States, Barack Obama can't go on a tour without bowing or giving apologies, or the Cairo speech, or contextualizing Christianity, and it's the subtext is always that the West is culpable for something, and that's sort of the theme of the progressive movement. And yet people who, you know, come into the United States are not hearing positive propaganda. They're hearing negative from us, and yet they still want to come in. And so they must know something that our elites don't know. And then by the same token, their host countries are not friendly to the United States. Mexico has a terrible propaganda campaign against American racism and nativism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they don't hear good news about America from the country from which they're leaving to the country which they're arriving, and yet they still want to come. And that should tell us something.
And you talk, this will be the final question I put to you. You talk in this piece about how our affluence in the West actually sort of undercuts in a weird way our sense of cultural pride. You end the column with this very poignant quote. I'll just read it here for the audience. "The richer, freer, and more technologically pampering that life becomes for self-critical native Westerners, the whinier they become." So, Victor, I mean, so much of the Western way of life revolves around market economics and the idea that at some level, if not across the board, we've sort of figured out this wealth thing, that we know how to make societies prosperous. And yet you read a passage like that of yours and you can't help but think that in some real way that prosperity can end up being a sort of cultural liability. Is that something that is avoidable, or is it just sort of inevitable that a prosperous society ends up becoming a sort of soft society?
I think it – well, Catullus, the great Roman lyric poet, said nothing's more injurious than a long, soft peace. And the Romans had this word luxus, which meant kind of like license or even decadence rather than just luxury. And when you have an iPhone and you can get information from all over the world in a nanosecond, or you can call any country in the world for pennies, or you're watching things like the Kardashians, I mean, these are not elemental questions of food and shelter. And yet people coming in here from Mexico are elemental. On my road where I live, there's people who came from Mexico. They rent out a home. They bring in chickens. They bring in turkeys. They bring in goats. They bring in sheep. They bring in pit bulls. They have cockfights. It's life like it was in the 19th century, and yet the postmodern society can't deal with it because they can't walk over there and say, you know, you're violating all these zones. You're a guest here in my country. I do not want to have a goat cross the street. This pit bull does not have a license. By the way, your child has scabies. You should treat that. You can't say that because the postmodern mind is so affluent and conditioned and that never sees that stuff, and so it doesn't want to be judgmental, and it's relativist. So it's a very strange mix when these immigrants come in and then they demand, or they tell the host, this is how I'm going to live in your country. And the host is sort of like H.G. Wells' Eloy, you know. They're just sort of listless. And then the Morlocks, of course, say, this is what we're going to do. They're elemental. They know what life's about. They know how to struggle for one more day's food. And we've lost that concept in the West, and it's reflected in the fact that we can't make judgments, we can't defend our civilization, we can't tell people, if you come to our country, you must do it legal, and you're not going to abide by your customs, you're going to abide by our custom. If you don't like it, leave. That is a very practical, empirical way of thinking, and yet it's just me repeating it on the radio sounds almost as if I'm racist or nativist.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.